Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, August 25th. I'm Ray Graff. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing a continuum of care for seniors, offering them opportunities to live at age gracefully with dignity and respect. DaughtersofSarah.org. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. Siobhan Kuhar of Albany ENT and Allergy Services. Dr. Kuhar practices general otolaryngology with a special interest in sleep medicine. She treats patients with clinical disorders involving the ear, nose, and throat, both medically and surgically, as well as those specifically related to sleep. If you have a question for Dr. Kuhar, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. In the studio this afternoon is Dr. Siobhan Kuhar. Since joining Albany ENT and Allergy Services in 2005 as a general otolaryngologist, Dr. Kuhar went on to receive board certification in the subspecialties of allergy and sleep medicine. Dr. Kuhar treats patients with clinical disorders involving the ear, nose, and throat, both medically and surgery, as well as those specifically related to sleep. In fact, she spearheaded the introduction of hypoglossal nerve stimulation to treat obstructive sleep apnea in the Capital Region. The number to call, it's a wide range of topics today. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Siobhan Kuhar, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
Good summer.
Great summer.
Great to have you here. And, you know, when you're on the show, we can cover so many topics, but really, you have been for some time really focused on sleep.
Yes. Yeah. That's been most of my career, actually.
What is hypoglossal nerve stimulation? I know you've told me before.
People see the ads all the time for the Inspire, which is really the only hypoglossal nerve stimulator on the market. And, you know, basically, it's an alternative to positive airway pressure therapy, but this is for people who really can't tolerate that gold standard treatment of CPAP, APAP, BiPAP. These are all types of positive airway pressure that are used to overcome the obstruction.
Now, why would someone not be able to tolerate? Is this just a comfort thing, or is there a physical, medical reason why someone couldn't tolerate a CPAP?
I have had certainly instances where patients had, for example, stents in their tear ducts or have had prior surgeries that don't allow them to tolerate any kind of, things on their face or air being blown up their nose or that sort of thing. But I would say that the majority of patients have tried CPAP, have either discovered that they have terrible claustrophobia or that they were taking the device off during their sleep. They were unable to fall asleep with it or would take it off during their sleep unconsciously. Yeah.
You know, years ago I had very bad apnea and I had a CPAP. And once, it took a day or two, but once I used it, it was the most wonderful thing in the whole wide world.
Well, thankfully for the majority of people, I would say, you know, they can overcome a lot of those obstacles and, you know, are able to adapt to it. But there still remain people who, you know, are just unable to or have for a very long time. And now, you know, things in their lives change and maybe they've decided that, you know, they want to do more camping or backpacking or biking across Europe and taking a CPAP isn't always part of that, you know.
Although they're much smaller now than when I had them.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
like the UNIVAC computer. It took up a room when
That's
I had
true.
Mine.
That's true. That's true.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. If you have a question for Dr. Siobhan Kuhar, her subspecialties are allergy and sleep medicine. Really, those are her specialties. And I'm going to throw an ear question at you, though.
Sure.
Okay? You're at Albany ENT. This happens every summer to my lovely offspring. What is swimmer's ear, and why does it afflict only some people?
Well, that's a good question, why it only afflicts some people. I don't know that we have an answer for that. But in general, swimmer's ear is because of that moisture in the ear canal leading to the overgrowth of bacteria.
So it's an infection?
It's an infection.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So treated with antibiotics? I mean, most times you just buy over-the-counter ointments or whatever.
Well, usually the over-the-counters are going to be the swimmer's ear drop, which is a combination of alcohol and acetic acid. So the alcohol helps to dry the ear. The acetic acid helps to acidify the canal, which is antibacterial and antifungal.
Ah.
So, yeah, the moisture, you know, just like when you have too much moisture anywhere on the body, you get a breakdown of that skin barrier. And the skin barrier is our number one barrier to infection. And so, you know, in the ear canal, if the ear canal remains moist, wet from being in and out of the water, then it starts to break down as a barrier for infection. And the staph that are, or other bacteria like Pseudomonas that are in the waters that we're swimming in, or, you know, even just on the skin itself, can then invade and become, you know, more of a pathogen.
But it's so funny. Some kids get them and some kids do not get it.
Well, there's a huge variety in the shape and size of the ear canal.
Is it the eustachian tubes that cause the problem?
No. It has nothing to do with the eustachian tube. The eustachian tube is connected to the middle ear, which is basically on the other side of the eardrum.
Uh-huh.
Right? So
I've had a middle ear infection before and they're not fun.
Awful.
The number here is 800-348-2551. And our guest today is Dr. Siobhan Kuhar of Albany ENT and Allergy Services. How's the allergy season this year?
You know, I mean, I feel like every year we say the same thing, which it seems
stinks.
That this year's worse than last year, than the year before that. So, but, you know, a number of different reasons for that.
The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. A couple of emails. They're going to be all over the place today. You got a sleep question? We're good with that. Ear question? Good with that. Allergy question? Good with that. This is an ear question from Denise. Are there any new treatments for preventing vertigo? Does taking vitamin D and calcium do anything to prevent it?
I've not heard or read of particular supplements preventing vertigo, because vertigo is kind of a laundry list of different potential causes. You know, first, you know, it can be from your inner ear, but it can also be what we call central. So from the brain, you know, from balance itself is very complex. It's part of our visual system, the inner ear, the cerebellum, receptors in our joints. You know, I mean, that the complexity of the system, of course, leads to the laundry list of potential causes. But I would say from an inner ear perspective, probably the most common that we will see is benign positional vertigo, these otoliths that are in our semicircular canals migrate into the wrong space.
And these are crystals. These are what they call the crystals, right?
Yeah, we call them crystals, calcium carbonate crystals.
What do they do?
So you have six semicircular canals, three on each side, and basically within those canals, they're bony structures within the skull that have nerve endings, you know, which are essentially little receptors. And they're sort of in this gelatinous matrix, and then you have these canal liths that sit in there. And every time you turn your head in a certain direction, those otoliths kind of brush up against those, you know, receptors in the semicircular canals. The right ear, the left ear send signals to the brain, and the brain processes that.
So I'm standing, or I'm... It's kind of a gyroscopic...
Right, I've looked to the left and, you know, it helps with the tracking of the eyes and everything, you know. But when one of these canal liths migrates into a wrong space, let's say, then the brain suddenly is getting a mixed signal. And so it takes about 30 seconds to kind of readjust to that. And so with benign positional vertigo, people will... know exactly, you know, if I turn my head to the right or roll over in bed or go from lying down to sitting up or bend over, what have you, that, you know, is very reproducible to them. And if they just stay very still, it will dissipate after less than a minute, typically.
Or you can do the hilarious to watch Epley maneuver.
Oh, yes.
Which my children enjoyed greatly when they were young. I've had this a couple of times. What causes positional vertigo?
So, you know, it's not really well understood why some people are more prone to it. But basically, once that happens, then it is more likely to happen again.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Number here is 800-348-2551. A Renaissance doctor is with us today, Dr. Siobhan Kuhar. This is an allergy question. I don't know. I don't even know what half this stuff means. This is from Jane in Sheffield, Massachusetts, who says, I have concerns about having the alpha gal allergy after having two tick bites 4 years ago. I tested for it. It came out with a low positive at 0.36. I retested 2 years ago. Came out higher, 0.49. I haven't had meat since the tick bite for the simple reason that I wanted to make sure I don't have the allergy before eating any meat or gelatin. So because I haven't had meat, I can't even say I've had a reaction. After the first test, I was told it's probably okay for me to eat meat. After the second higher test, I was told to avoid it. What's your opinion of a low positive alpha gal result? I would love to have spaghetti and meatballs, but I'm terrified of having a severe reaction. That's from Jane in Sheffield. Quickly, what's an alpha gal allergy?
So alpha gal is sugar on the, you know, within certain mammalian meat and dairy products. And for reasons of, it seems, molecular mimicry, you know, where you get a tick bite, your body makes an antibody response. That antibody happens to be reacting to a portion of the protein that's very similar to a protein that this alpha gal sugar component of these mammalian meats. So the symptoms can range, you know, from, you know, just kind of mild hives or itching to more severe anaphylactic, you know, reactions of low blood pressure or, really severe reactions. So it's recommended because, you know, for some people, those antibody levels will dissipate over time to follow that. And if they continue to decline, then, you know, there's consideration, again, depending on the severity of the initial reaction, of reintroducing and testing, basically, whether or not the person now tolerates the food. So it's a difficult question to answer based on numbers because it also depends on severity of reaction. You would never suggest that somebody who had a very severe reaction, perhaps requiring epinephrine or hospitalization or what have you, you know, you would probably then counsel, or I would probably counsel, you know, just avoidance.
Yeah.
You know, but again, there is some data to suggest that that is an allergy that can dissipate over time. However, it can also recur with additional tick bites. So, you know, 5 years later, you get bitten by a tick again, you have to be concerned that you may, again, reignite, so to speak, that sensitivity.
So Jane's went up from a 0.36 to a 0.49.
Right.
Then you would suggest that probably another tick bite happened in the intervening time.
It's certainly possible.
All right, let's take a quick break here. Dr. Siobhan Kuhar joins us today. Let's see. Let me put the list down. You got a question about allergies. You got a question about otolaryngology. You got a question about sleep medicine. It's one-stop shopping today. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Dizzy Gillespie. 800-348-2551. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Dr. Siobhan Kuhar from Albany ENT and Allergy Services. And before we hit the phones, just a quick sleep question for me. This is a confession. A couple times this week, I've had trouble sleeping. I took melatonin. Is this bad to take on a regular basis?
Not bad. I think the problem that some people will run into is they think that more is better, and it's not. You know, I would say in my practice, I generally recommend, you know, if you're going to take it to help with sleep onset, first of all, you would never take it in the middle of the night. You always take it at the very beginning of the night.
I did that once.
Because you will feel hungover from it the next day if you take it in the middle of the night. So melatonin is something that the brain naturally makes as part of the transition to sleep. You know, it is actually released by our brains under circumstances of dim light. So bright light will suppress it. And this is another reason for, you know, avoidance of light from screens and phones.
Don't leave the TV on then.
Absolutely not, the television, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, because that inhibits the body's natural melatonin secretion. So in my practice, I'll say, you know, look, if you want to try 3 or 5 milligrams of melatonin, you know, usually about half an hour before intended bedtime. Also, you know, avoiding the light exposure that will suppress your body's own natural melatonin secretion. There's not really a significant downside there. But again, going to higher doses generally won't be of benefit.
Will the human body, in this case mine, if I were to take it on a regular basis, which I don't do, but if I did, would I get a tolerance to it?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't believe so, but, you know, I guess another question that brings to my mind is, would it actually, in a way, suppress your own natural secretion of melatonin?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to
but
that either.
That decreases as one ages, right?
It does. You know, these retinal ganglion cells that, you know, are controlling that dim light onset of the melatonin by the pituitary, you know, that does diminish over time.
Our guest today is Dr. Siobhan Kuhar from Albany ENT and Allergy Services. The number here is 800-348-2551. All right, let's go to the phones and see what happens. We'll begin in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Russ. Russ, you're up.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I broke out in hives a couple of weeks ago. And I don't have food allergies. And I assumed that the reason was a week before I got stung by a bunch of small wasps. And I was treated with antihistamines. But I was talking to another doctor friend the other day, and he said, oh, no, you know, if you got stung a week before, that couldn't have done it. It must have been something that happened shortly before you got the hives. And the only thing that I could think of was I tried a hazelnut milk that I'd never had before the morning that I noticed the hives. So I was calling to ask, can an allergic reaction happen days later, or does it have to happen pretty much immediately?
So interesting.
So that type 1 hypersensitivity, which then leads to hives, for example, or swelling, or, you know, what we would consider a type of anaphylactic reaction, is usually within minutes of exposure. I would agree with your friend that it doesn't seem likely that the bee sting allergies, the hornet allergy, what have you, that happened a week earlier was likely the cause. However, you know, if you have a known allergy to, you know, and then the class of these flying, stinging things are called Hymenoptera, it could be that that then heightened the histamine level in your body, making you, mm-hmm. you know, the threshold for another allergic reaction to be lower. So something that maybe you've had just very minor reactions to in the past, like hazelnut, you know, became a little bit more relevant because it came on the tail of a, you know, an initial, you know, allergic response. So that's possible. Also, when people take, and I don't know what antihistamines you were taking, but if you were taking relatively high levels of antihistamines for several days, then, you know, you can also, in stopping them, have some rebound hives. So so that can happen as well. We see that a lot in patients who have been, for example, taking, you know, Zyrtec for several years, and then they try to stop it, and suddenly they're breaking out in hives. So there can be sort of this rebound histamine response.
All right, Russ, thanks a lot for the call. Our guest today is Dr. Siobhan Kuhar from Albany ENT and Allergy Services. 800-348-2551. What does a histamine do? It's naturally produced in the body, right?
Yeah, histamine, you know, I mean, there are a number of different histamines and histamine receptors, you know, everything from histamine in the brain, which is a neurotransmitter that's important for wakefulness. And this is why many antihistamines, you know, make you drowsy.
Yeah.
Exactly. If they cross over into the brain. But there are histamine receptors in the gut. You know, this is what the H2 blockers, you know, which are like famotidine, Pepcid, you know, all those
right.
types of medications kind of working on. But.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Let's go to Kingston. Larry, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I have a statement and a question.
Okay.
So I've had some experience for a long time with chronic swimmer's ear. And a couple of years ago, I got a custom ear plug, molded to the inner ear, and I haven't had an infection since.
Huh. Okay, Doc, what do you think?
Yeah, well, again, you know, anything that can prevent moisture from getting into the ear will prevent a swimmer's ear, you know.
Yeah.
People who are prone to them will often tell them to, you know, after they shower, to use a blow dryer, you know, just anything that will help to dry the ear canal will help with that.
All right, Larry.
It works really well for me.
Good.
And then the question I had was, I have Meniere's disease, and I was wondering if there's any new treatments for it.
Yeah, not to my knowledge. You know, again, you know, Meniere's disease, for those who have never heard of it, is a combination of episodes of vertigo and hearing loss that occur because of a rupture of a membrane that separates fluids of the vestibular system and the cochlea. And the components of those systems is so different that when the fluids mix, the result is vertigo and hearing loss that's transient, and then the membrane reforms. But unfortunately, over time, what will happen is the hearing continues to decline, and the vertigo also declines. The triggers tend to be things like stress, allergy, high salt or sodium in the diet. But aside from that, we don't. Aside from things like diuretics, which can help to control these fluid imbalances, and also keeping to low sodium diet, taking an antihistamine, figuring out underlying causes, or you know, getting maybe better management strategies for stress. Although, you know, good luck in fully controlling that. So,
all right, yeah. Larry, thanks a lot. What would too much salt do? I mean, how would that cause the problem?
So again, because you have this membrane separates these fluids that are quite different in terms of their ionic, you know, components, the sodium causes what we call a hydrops in the middle ear, which is an accumulation of fluid. So that accumulation of fluid then causes rupture of this Reisner's membrane in our inner ear, a mixing of the fluids, and as I said, you know, an immediate decline in hearing and vertigo until the membrane reforms and the fluids equilibrate over that membrane. It's
I
quite
have never
fascinating.
Heard of that before. Just quickly going back to Larry's call, he said he had a custom ear plug made, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I see swimmers on TV or, you know, the Olympics or whatever, they wear nose plugs. They don't wear ear plugs. Why would you wear nose plugs?
Why would you wear nose plugs?
I mean, does that affect your ear?
That wouldn't affect swimmer's ear in any way.
Would it affect your ears in any way?
Well, I mean, your eustachian tube sits at the very back of the nose, but... You know, if you've ever gotten water up your nose that's not salt water, it's pretty darn uncomfortable. And I think that's more the reason that they do it. But, you know, I don't think it has to do with irritation of their eustachian tube.
All right. Well, thankfully, I'm not an Olympic swimmer, so I'll just leave it there. The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Siobhan Kuhar is an expert in allergy and sleep medicine and does a little otolaryngology as well. This email from Diana about melatonin. I used to do chronobiologic research, and though I'm no longer in that field, my understanding is that 3 milligrams or more of melatonin should be reserved for shifting your rhythms, such as flights across time zones, or circadian rhythm drift, such as staying up longer at night and then getting up later in the morning. In such cases, you take 3 milligrams of melatonin around 7 or 8 p.m. if you want to go to bed earlier. And at that time in the country you're headed on the headed to on the day of travel, and even 2 days before you travel, taking melatonin by mouth does suppress your body's normal secretion if you use it over time. That's from Diana. What do you think of that?
I think that's excellent. I mean, you know, I couldn't imagine having someone better than a chronobiologist answer
okay.
that question.
All right, fair enough. Cheryl writes in, this is about EpiPens. Now, we are all over the place today. Could you speak about the recently advertised alternative to the EpiPen? I guess the name is Neffy. I'm not sure. I've not heard of
sure.
this. Is it effective on all allergic reactions, such as bee stings, food allergies, or just respiratory, since it is a nasal spray? And does it have fewer side effects? And that's from Cheryl.
So, you know, it's been quite an exciting, new option for people to have an inhaled version of epinephrine. It is thought to be, or has been shown to be, as effective as injectable epinephrine. And it's not just for upper respiratory symptoms. It's, you know, for generalized anaphylaxis. But many people are terribly needle phobic, you know, to the point that they won't inject themselves with epinephrine when they really need to inject themselves with epinephrine.
Yeah.
Also, you know, if you can imagine, you know, if a teacher in school or a child visiting, a friend's house, and that child has an anaphylactic reaction, and the people they're visiting have absolutely no experience, that, you know, having that person then just inhale the epinephrine takes away, you know, the possibility of, you know, not appropriately injecting, you know, et cetera,
yeah.
you know, being afraid to. So
interesting.
Yeah, no, that's been quite exciting.
Number here is 800-348-2551. If you, you know, in these, the drug commercials scare the daylights out of me. And I am personally a proponent of having no drug commercials on TV, because they raise prices and everything else. But, and besides, what doctor wants me to come in and say, hey, say, have you heard about blank?
Mm-hmm.
I think you probably did. And you would prescribe it if you thought it was appropriate. But that's not my question. The ads all have terrible side effects, mostly. And they'll say, don't take if you're allergic to it, or if you feel sudden your throat closing up. If you had a situation where you felt something coming on, you didn't have an EpiPen, and you never had an issue like this before, but you thought, oh, my God, this is a terrible allergic reaction, can you just take a Benadryl or something like that, an oral antihistamine?
Well, you know, again, it really depends on the reaction. But if it were a person feeling as though their throat was closing, 911.
No, no. But in general, just in general, an allergy that came out of nowhere, that, my God, this could get bad. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Over-the-counter allergy medicine?
Benadryl is definitely helpful. But again, I can't emphasize enough that, you know, if you feel as though symptoms are escalating, and if this is in a critical area like your lungs, you know, an asthma attack or swelling in your airway, the first thing that happens is calling the ambulance.
It's a really good plan. All right, let's go to Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Two questions. About 50 years ago, I got kicked in the face with a horse while trying to do a digital artery surgery. I've had most of the maxillary teeth extracted, but now I'm getting a real heavy serous mucus discharge. Any ideas on that?
Well, it sounds like a pretty complex, injury that you had. Certainly, if it affected your maxilla, then it affected the maxillary sinuses. I would recommend seeing, you know, ENT in your area to start with, and then they will, you know, determine whether it's something that requires additional imaging, referral to maybe a sinus only or a rhinologist, you know, for further evaluation.
All right, Jim, thank you. Very quickly, we have a minute and a half here before the next break. Joan in Schenectady, you're on with Dr. Siobhan Kuhar.
Thank you so much, Ray, and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you.
And, Doctor, I love your first name. We share the same name, just in a different language.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, and I love the Gaelic. So my question is a pretty simple one. I'm able to control my nasal allergy symptoms with the over-the-counter loratadine, and I take just, you know, the recommended one a day. Can I just maintain it? It doesn't completely eliminate my allergic responses, and this year has been a doozy, but I'm not willing to, you know, go up to the 2 pills a day. Can I maintain on one for a long, 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 long time?
So the issues with the antihistamines as a drug class are that people will often develop tolerance to them, especially when taken on a daily basis. One tablet is the recommended dosing, not two. So going up on the dose, I don't think will provide you the benefit you're looking for. Changing the antihistamine may, but I would recommend, you know, if you struggle this much with your allergies, you may want to pursue this further, figure out what you're allergic to, start implementing some other maybe environmental controls. You know, if it's dust mite, the dust mite covers. If they're pollens and mold, close your windows. Getting in the habit of washing your nose with salt water, because our noses are basically filters. So all of those recommendations. But I mean, for starters, you may want to just change to a different over-the-counter antihistamine.
All right, Joan, we'll have to leave it there. We're going to take a break. Dr. Siobhan Kuhar is our guest today from Albany ENT and Allergy Services. We'll be back and check the email bag in a moment. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you, joined today by Dr. Siobhan Kuhar from Albany ENT and Allergy Services. Kind of a mixed bag today. We've had some sleep questions, some ear questions, some allergy questions. Bob writes in, a couple weeks ago, I developed a sore throat. Went to my Dr. Nostrep and no redness. Went to my doctor, period. Not strep and no redness in throat, but diagnosed post-nasal drip and suggested Claritin. Took it about a week, but it subsided, and I stopped taking Claritin. It returned, but not with a vengeance like the first time. It's going away again. How long can you keep taking Claritin?
I mean, you can take Claritin year-round, and there are people who certainly do have year-round allergies. But, you know, as I was just saying to Joan earlier, you can become tolerant to the antihistamine. So if you can use it more on an as-needed basis, that would be better. But that may mean seasonally, you know, spring, summer, fall, and then, you know, give it up for the winter, and it will maintain its effectiveness the following spring.
Is there any drawback, and I use this from time to time, I don't know what the actual generic name is, but Flonase. I use a generic
version.
And it really, really works, especially at night when I want to sleep. Is there a drawback? That's a steroid, right? Mm-hmm. Is there a drawback for long-term use on that?
So, you know, the warnings of many of the nasal sprays, whether it's an antihistamine or a nasal steroid, are that they can, you know, lead to overdrying of the nose and nosebleed.
Yeah.
But the nasal steroids in particular, because they're steroid, can over time thin the lining of the nose. And so, you know, we're very careful in the ENT practice to always instruct patients, whenever you put these nasal sprays, especially the nasal steroids in your nose, you want to aim them out towards your ear on the whatever side of your nose.
Interesting.
You're
not
putting
toward
that,
the
not
septum.
Not towards the nasal septum.
Interesting.
Because the blood vessels of the nasal septum are much more superficial than the ones on the lateral wall of nose. And all of the congestion is coming from most of the congestion is coming from the side walls of the nose, where we have these structures called inferior turbinates, which are like folds of tissue that increase surface area for the purpose of the nose, which we think is, you know, warming, filtering, humidifying the air.
Well, I've been doing it wrong. Don't. Peter in Barryville writes, if I'm stung by a wasp or a bee, say in the arm, my arm will swell to the point that where I look like Popeye. This will usually last for a week and become quite itchy before things return to normal. Am I in danger when this occurs? And that's from Peter in Barryville.
You know, you certainly can be. I mean, that sounds like a pretty significant allergic reaction bordering on, well, it is an anaphylactic reaction, just more localized. But my concern would be, what if the bee stings you in the head and neck area? What if the bee stings you in your mouth? Now, if you have swelling there, this is a much more critical area, which could lead to airway obstruction. So I would definitely recommend, you know, follow up on that. Start with your primary care doctor and at the very least get an EpiPen prescribed and learn, you know, how to use that. Because, again, you know, one never knows what the future holds. And, you know, we're also coming into a time of year when, you know, there's many more bees and, you know, wasps and hornets and things like that. And, yeah. You know, if you're outside, you're drinking a can of soda, what have you, you know, they can climb inside. And, you know, this is something that that happens not uncommonly.
EpiPens are only by prescription?
Yes.
Because I was wondering, should everyone have one in their house in case they have a guest come over?
I mean, you know, the appropriate use of EpiPen, not, you know, we don't take this lightly. It is a medication. It does have potential side effects. It can transiently raise blood pressure, heart rate, you know. So,
which is theoretically better than dying if your airway is obstructed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good question.
All right.
You know, I'm not sure what all the, you know, reasons are for not just providing that to every household, but yeah.
Kind of a go kit. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's jump back to the phones. We'll check the email in a little bit. Let's go to Niskayuna. Chuck, you're on. Hello, Chuck.
Yes, good afternoon. Question about tinnitus. So it manifests in very quiet rooms. So what I actually say is I can't hear silence anymore. But in so a question, you know, what is treatments? And the direction they for me was they said, well, you need to get hearing aids because, and I've heard this from several people, that you'll start to lose frequency recognition. You'll start to decline. And then if you get later hearing aids, you've already lost that ability. Can you just speak to that?
Isn't tinnitus a nerve thing?
So it's the brain's response to the loss of the neurons, you know, which, you know, it's actually not that well understood, honestly. But it is true that by amplifying that frequency externally, and whether that's with the sound machine or by programming a hearing aid, you can teach the brain or, you know, how should I say, almost like negate this phantom sound that your brain is providing for your entertainment, you know. So
it's not entertaining.
Not entertaining.
No.
But it, again, is thought to be due to the nerve loss. And, you know, the treatments are still masking, which would be, you know, providing some external sound of a similar frequency to help negate what.
So you phase it out?
That phantom sound.
So you're phasing this?
Yeah. And oftentimes people will learn to kind of ignore the sound over time. But there are biofeedback type programs, one called Neuromonics, where they introduce the frequency of the tinnitus into the background of music. You listen to that soundtrack for an hour or two every day, increase the relative contribution of that frequency of sound that you're experiencing, and then over time your brain learns to ignore it.
I'll be darned.
So, so I think that, you know, in part it is also true that it gets harder to do that as we get older, and I think that speaks more to the plasticity of the nervous system and the ability to kind of
adapt.
Yeah.
Chuck, you want to follow up?
No, just to be clear then, you're recommending don't wait too far into this for hearing aids?
Oh, I definitely wouldn't wait too far. I think that is a problem that many people decide to pursue hearing aids, you know, when they're really impaired by that.
Yeah.
You know, and it becomes much more difficult for the brain to adapt to that now amplification of these frequencies that it hasn't experienced in,
so
years.
Chuck, thanks for the call. Will they work with headphones?
What's that? Tinnitus masking?
No. Will hearing aids work with headphones?
Oh, yeah.
Really? Yeah, maybe I'll consider that. My children say I'm deaf as a post, and it might well be. And actually, it might be a defense mechanism on account of the kids. Kamina is in Albany. Kamina, you're on.
Hi. I have a son who is severely allergic to shrimp. I don't understand this number, but you will understand it. It's like 13.5. And like, let's just say, for example, the lobster was 14.2. And so he's been going to an allergist in New York City for trying to desensitize him. And so, for example, like with clam, which was 3.0, he did well. And for oysters, which is 2.0, he did well. But then with clam, which is 4.0, he didn't do well. And they just stopped the testing. And so we were going to go further and try to desensitize him to shrimp. They don't have any desensitization for scallops. They don't have any desensitization for lobster. The desensitization for shrimp would cost, let's just say, approximately $10,000 altogether. I'm wondering, is it worth it, considering that there's no protocol for a desensitization to scallop or lobster or other things that he could come in contact with. I was wondering, what did you think?
So food allergies often fall into these food families. And so lobster, shrimp, crayfish, these are all within the same food family. But things like bivalves and mollusks, which would be more of the clam and oyster, et cetera, are in different food families.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know a lot about food desensitization, more about what's been done with peanut, because the severity of the reaction for some people is, really life-threatening. So I think a lot of it has to do with the severity of the allergy. Hmm. It is true that some people's allergies will dissipate over time, so that a person who may have had a food allergy as a child may outgrow, so to speak, that allergy as an adult. So, the number one recommendation is still avoidance. But, whether or not to pursue this desensitization, I think probably depends a lot on the severity of the allergic reaction to begin with. And yes, if it's a life-threatening reaction, it may be worth pursuing that. But really, the desensitization protocols are all aimed to not eliminate the allergy. So you still have to avoid the allergen, but just to reduce the severity of that allergic reaction.
Kamina, thanks a lot for the call. Dana writes in, this is an interesting one. Subject heading, can't smell, 45 years. Lost my sense of smell and taste some 45 years ago, post-antibiotics due to a C-section. Just heard about new way to stimulate these lost senses. And do you know anything about this?
Loss of sense of smell and taste, and there's a great deal of overlap there, has been something that's been, very much in the public consciousness in the COVID era, because COVID would, certain subtypes of it were doing that very commonly, either transiently or, unfortunately for some people, permanently. But before that, people would have upper respiratory infections or, have other reasons for losing their smell and taste. But most often it was kind of a post-viral, condition. So, I wouldn't say that this is at all a new therapy, but there, is some role for reteaching the brain by using purified essential oils. to kind of, you know, with familiar smells to help kind of entrain. But I would say also, you know, when I just mentioned the smell and taste, if a person has lost their sense of smell but also reports a complete loss of taste, then that, you know, is true anosmia. If a person has a decrease in their sense of smell but their sense of taste is reduced or still okay, it's quite likely that their sense of smell will return as well.
Interesting.
I think seeing an ENT is always a good idea for this, only because sometimes patients lose their sense of smell and taste because of structural problems within the nose, such as nasal polyps. That's a very, you know, common cause of loss of sense of smell and taste. And, you know, if you're on antibiotics for sinus infections, maybe you have nasal polyps that are, you know, have created a barrier for the olfactory nerve endings in the roof of the nose.
Can they be operated on and removed?
Oh, yes. And they can also be treated non-surgically. You know, there are a number of different therapies
out
there.
How do you get rid of them without surgery?
Sure. So it in part depends on why they're there to begin with, but, you know, it's something that not all people with allergies get or not all people with chronic rhinosinusitis get, but in those where we think that the basis of the polyps is due to eosinophilia, there's treatments, you know, injectables that help to treat that eosinophilic pathway and the polyps kind of disappear. You know, historically, nasal steroids can also help, and that we can sometimes, you know, use just topical, you know, steroid rinses, things like that to help relieve polyp load.
Dr. Siobhan Kuhar is our guest today. We only have about a minute here, so I'll read you this email. I thought it was interesting from Dave. Recently, when I used Debrox eardrops to remove earwax, it drained out as usual from my right ear, but would not drain properly from my left ear, regardless of how long I maintained my head in a tilted position for draining. I flushed my ears with water as directed, and that helped a bit, but fluids in the left ear still would not drain out properly. Do you know why this might be? The other reason I'm asking is because over the several days it took for me to get the stuff out of my ear, I experienced significant hearing loss, which, needless to say, was a bit scary. And that's from Dave. We have about 30 seconds.
Sure. So, you know, it's quite likely that you had a wax impaction, and sometimes Debrox alone is not enough. And even with the irrigation, it can be so adherent that you really need to have it mechanically removed by an ear, nose, and throat doctor. So, you know, at Albany ENT, we do have an urgent care available Monday to Friday, you know, 8 to
you could just
or
come
in the
in
afternoon. If, you can walk in.
Ah,
know,
very interesting. So. By the way, you know, over the years since hypoglossal nerve stimulation became a thing, has it overtaken CPAP?
No, no. CPAP is still considered our gold standard for treatment, and that's the vast majority of my patients, how they are treated.
Well, anyway, Dr. Siobhan Kuhar, you have answered questions in a wide range of topics today. Great job. Maybe we'll see you next year.
Thanks for having me.
And maybe we'll focus it a little more next time.
It's fine.
Support comes from Berkshire Plastic Surgeons in Great Barrington and Pittsfield, offering skin cancer screenings, Botox injections, fillers, cosmetic, and reconstructive surgery. BerkshirePlasticSurgeons.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Siobhan Kuhar for being with us today from Albany ENT and Allergy Services. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the calls and the emails. Sorry if we didn't get to your question. We had a million of them today. Thanks to our engineer, Riley Phillips. Thanks to Bob Rathman, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, well, I'm doing a live event tomorrow. But Sarah LeDuc will be in the chair, and we'll talk climate change and green energy with Dan DeLurie. That's tomorrow at 2. We'll see you.